And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells here with Lynn Ware Peak. Our next guest, Bill Andrews, Senior Associate Editor from Discover Magazine. Every year in early January, we sit down with Bill to discuss the most important science stories of the previous year and their potential impact into the future. The State of Science 2019 edition has just hit the newsstands, and it covers the top stories in medicine, archaeology, technology, genetics, space, and more. Bill Andrews, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure to be here. I always have a good time. Thank you.
And we do as well. Maybe you can start off by telling us the difference this year, because the last several years we've been doing the top science stories for the previous year, and this magazine is a little different.
Yeah, usually our big double issue for the January-February month at Discover Magazine is a top 100 stories of the previous year. So this year it's a little different. Instead of having the top 100 stories of 2018, we're calling it the State of Science 2019. And the idea being that instead of kind of artificially choosing exactly 100 stories and trying to keep a nice mix between the different disciplines, the archaeology and the biology and astronomy and all the different ones, it could be a little more like we felt we were becoming more slaves to the format rather than letting the stories themselves kind of dictate how we talked about them. So one of the classic examples that we started griping to each other about was that, you know, when we had to actually choose the lineup, the top 10 was always kind of a fun discussion. Oh, I think this story is the most important. Oh, well, this one's pretty good, but number 4, that's fine. But by the time it got into the 50s or 60s, and you're talking about, well, this story's, I'd say this is an 80s level, but not more than that. And this could be number 100. This is barely, do we even need this one? And so, you know, if you're talking about, do we really need a story? Is it that important? Is it worth keeping? We thought, let's try something fresh this year and just talk about each individual science. Like I said, genetics and space and math and medicine, just each one is its own section, and we talk about the kind of biggest stories from those sections of the year. And so some will be a little more jam-packed than others, some will be more visual, some will be more kind of explaining the concepts, and hopefully everyone likes it. Hopefully the readers enjoy the new approach to kind of the same idea of sharing an overview of what happened of the year, and particularly this time looking forward with it as well, laying out where we are now so that we can see what is going to happen this year and in the future years.
Yeah, and they are important stories that will not only play a major role in science media in 2019, but as you say, going forward from there. And something that caught my attention last year was this whole this big heat spell in Europe. You had cows that were dying in the field. There were 105, 110 degree temperatures in Spain and in Portugal. You had an iceberg the size, it's the largest iceberg in Greenland that if it breaks off could cause a tsunami. So one of the articles or one of the vignettes that I like was on page 35. It's called Current Weakening. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's about the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, which is a nice fancy scientific phrase that we just call AMOC. That's what the scientists call it. A lot of run amok headlines come from that. It's been a great boon to the science writing community. But the idea being that the Atlantic Ocean has these streams, these currents within it, kind of rivers flowing within the ocean itself, that have been really good at regulating temperatures in the northern hemisphere. And because of this and some other ocean currents, that's why some of the locations in Europe, Spain and France and those areas, Italy, they're really far north. If you look at them on a map, they're way farther north than you expect, partly based on they have such nice temperate climates. They get warm in the summer, they don't get too cold in the winter, right? And part of that is because this AMOC, the ocean currents, balances that out. It warms it a little in the winter. It cools it down in the summer. That's because it transfers warmer water from the tropics up north into the poles, where it cools down, sinks a little below the warmer water. Colder water is denser, so it sinks. and then that gets transported back down to the tropical region. So that current, that circulation is really important for regulating the climate that we are used to in the Northern Hemisphere. But unfortunately, it's not looking too great for those right now. Like a lot of other climate stories, this one isn't a super happy ending currently, because in 2018, the current slowed down to a record low. And if they were to, you know, if they keep on that trend, it would mean not just these unfortunate implications for these very far north areas, Europe and the northern Europe and even north parts of North America, but even related climate issues, like it would cause a sea level rise on the U.S.'s eastern seaboard, again, because of the whole warmer waters are on top and they're kind of more spread out than colder waters and that density issue. So this, if that current weakens, it can have, it can impact all kinds of issues. And, you know, right now it's weakening and we don't want to see it weaken too much further.
Yes, that's right. Well, Bill, in this interview, we're going to jump around a lot because there's so many different areas from, you know, like you're talking about climate change and environment. There's genetics and human origins and archaeology and paleontology and neuroscience and medicine and many other areas.
My.
So, but what when you were talking about sea levels rising, I don't know, it just made me think about the land bridge and the migration that was seen about 20,000 years ago from Siberia to Alaska. And, you know, in archaeology, I think it's because there have been so many advances in how to test DNA that it was a huge year for archaeology. One thing that I found really interesting was this discovery, and it wasn't last year, a couple of years ago, that the inner ear can preserve up to 100 times more DNA than other skeletal parts. I thought that was interesting. And this was a story that you kind of like, too. Can you talk a little bit about the migration of the early Americans?
Yeah. Like you said, that that bone that they found in the ear, the Petrus bone, has been a real boon to archaeologists because it contains so much of the of that ancient DNA. Like you said, they call it ADNA, for ancient DNA, and it's really opened up kind of a new window for researchers to be able to look at the past through. It's one thing to be able to sift through fossils and place them, date them to the ground records and see what period they come from and piece together what we know. That's fine, the artifacts, the bones and everything, but that only tells you part of the story. And being able to find these kind of treasure troves of DNA in some of these samples really, you know, ramps that up. And not just that that new ear bone, too, but just generic tech advances. Being able to analyze DNA faster, quicker, better, you know, like the Olympics. It's been really amazing few years in archaeology. And, yeah, in particular, that the early Americans that we've discovered, there's a whole kind of new tribe, although that might even, it's bigger than a tribe, a whole group of migrating Americans, as they might have then have been, they wouldn't have known her, but we would call them that, from our modern vantage point. Like you said, the land bridge from Asia to North America, out there through Alaska, we'd long known that people had been crossing that to get into North America in the first place, and there had been branches out as they go south into from Canada into the United States, and then some stuff happened, right? And then different groups go into South America, and that's how a lot of the indigenous people in this in these continents, that's where they came from. But thanks to this new approach to ancient DNA sequencing, we've learned that about 11,500 years ago, there was a group of people that we didn't even know about in Alaska, and they had separated from the main groups doing all the other crossing through the continents that we knew about. And the only reason we knew about them is because we found the remains of two infants that were covered up in red pigment, buried in a grave. And like I said, they dated that to about 12,000 years ago. And when they analyzed their DNA, they realized this is a genetically distinct group of North Americans, of native North Americans. So it's not of any of the other tribes, any other peoples that we knew about. And that's exciting, not just because, hey, now we know about them, now we have a better picture a better understanding of that era. But it also makes you think, well, if we didn't know anything about this one group and we suddenly found them through a kind of a chance encounter of these bones, these remains, surely then they can't be the only ones. Probably there must be other groups out there, other, you know, peoples, other tribes that also existed, that also had their own journeys through the continents, that maybe once we find them, we'll be able to learn their stories as well. So, yeah, it's been really exciting. We've learned a lot about, you know, our own ancestors as human beings and as North Americans here.
Yeah, that's a fascinating story. And then also within that story, researchers found that groups separated and went completely, you know, on separate paths, later reuniting on their journey to South America. That's that's fascinating. Was that a discovery also in this most recent research?
Yeah, that was a separate finding, but it's part of the same kind of genre of this ancient DNA and new technological abilities applying to archaeology. And so, yeah, not just this you know new tribe of people that we found up near Alaska, but even being able to, through their genomes, through the DNA, chart kind of the stories of these different groups and see how they split off at one point around, 20,000 years ago almost, and then a few thousand years after that, they reunite, they somehow come back together and become one peoples again as they keep trekking through the continents, going through Central America into South America, and being able to, again, tell that story through, and we learn about it through their DNA.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Bill Andrews, who's the senior associate editor for Discover Magazine. We're talking to him about the 2019 issue, just hit the newsstands, The State of Science. And Bill, the magazine is broken up into some major sections. One of those major sections is a very favorite section of both of ours, and that's space. And you talk about the solar system, all the planets. You talk about artificial satellites that are close to the sun, like Parker Solar Probe, which we've had on the show. Well, we haven't had the spaceship on the show, but we had
that would be amazing.
Had the person in charge of the instrumentation package. We had Alan Stern on the program back in April to talk about. He was the mission manager for Ultima Thule, which is the furthest out from the solar system. And anyway, it's that section's jam-packed with all sorts of cool stuff. But because our time is limited, I wanted to ask you about neutrinos. And a lot of people don't know what they are and why we should know anything about them in the first place. Maybe you can tell us a little bit.
Sure. I would include a lot of scientists who don't know exactly what they are. That's part of the enigma of neutrinos. So what we do know is that they're these little tiny particles. We're familiar with protons and neutrons and electrons, right? Those are the classic building blocks of atoms and everything else. And neutrinos, how do they fit into that? Well, they're very tiny, like those. But unlike protons and neutrons, they don't have a charge. So they're neutral as well, but they're much smaller. And so that's where the name comes from the Italian neutrino, right? Like little neutral ones. It's not positino. No. Neutrino. And part of what makes them really special.
Are you moving your hands?
I absolutely am. I realize you can't see it. I am, of course, using my hands. It's not pronounced correctly otherwise. But what makes neutrinos really special is that they can go through matter without disturbing it, without interacting with it. The sun, for example, produces neutrinos all the time, like we think all stars do. And so each one of us today, every day, every moment has tons of neutrinos just streaming through us, going right through our bodies, through our bones, and we don't feel it, doesn't affect us, it doesn't matter, because that's how little they interact with stuff. Neutrinos are very high-minded. They don't interact with anybody, anything. They do their own thing, right? So how do we even know they exist? Well, that's very complicated. It took decades to really find them after they were first posited and theorized, and we know they exist, but we don't know that much more about them. And so what happened last year that was a big deal is that this huge detector at the South Pole called IceCube, right? Very funny, but it also stands for, you know, I'm sure they came up with a great acronym for what the individual letters could mean. And a giant detector of neutrinos. And the idea being that even though neutrinos go through stuff almost all the time without anyone noticing, without any interactions, you get enough stuff out there, like a huge block of ice, a kilometer on every side, a cube that is that big, and enough neutrinos streaming through it, as the sun produces, as we have all the time, eventually some of those neutrinos will bump into some of the material, some of the ice in that cube. And so that's how they're able to detect neutrinos at IceCube. And the special thing, the amazing thing from 2018 is that, well, technically this happened in 2017, but it was reported in 2018. The analysis was in 2018. And that's that at IceCube, they detected a neutrino that wasn't from the sun. It came from, as far as they could tell, deep space. Already exciting. That's a new thing. They hadn't found anything like that before. But it gets better because when they traced its path, you know, through the detector, when they saw where it came from and they ran it in reverse, it pointed to a specific destination, a blazar that was in a galaxy 3.7 billion light years away. And so what's a blazar? It's a funny name for kind of a big, dramatic black hole that is spewing energy and matter and is pointed right at us. And so from our vantage point, it looks like this thing that we call a blazar is just throwing up tremendous amounts of stuff at us, right? And so, okay, they found that this neutrino, if you run its path backwards, points at this blazar. So it makes sense to think it probably came from the blazar. And that's all well and good, but that isn't enough for scientists, right? Because something making sense, we need more. We need more proof than that. And the proof that they got to confirm those findings, or at least, you know, make them that much more likely, is that at the same time that IceCube, the detector, found this neutrino, other detectors around the world were finding another kind of radiation called gamma rays. And those were also coming from this black hole, this blazar. And together, the most likely outcome, the hugely most likely outcome, is that this black hole is producing these different kinds of radiation, the neutrinos, the gamma rays, probably other stuff that we just aren't picking up. And that together they traveled all that distance, 3.7 billion light years, to get to us, and then that's how we know that this thing is producing neutrinos, which we didn't know. We didn't know black holes could make neutrinos, and we still aren't really sure how that could be the case, but that's the almost inescapable conclusion that we now come to from this discovery.
Wow, you could probably talk about neutrinos for the rest of the interview, Bill.
I don't know if that's a compliment, or, but thank you.
Well, no, it's I'm glad you're passionate. That's a great thing. So I'm going to just test your limits a bit because I'm going to reel you back in from space, and we're going to go into cloning. So in 1996, Dolly the sheep, as we, most of us remember, the first cloned mammal, but it was always difficult and unsuccessful to clone primates. Last year, news of the first cloned monkeys, Zhang Zhang and Wawa. We've heard about cloning. We understand it at a basic level, but what I didn't realize was the transfer of DNA into the embryonic cells and taking the existing DNA out. And so can you talk about that process?
Sure. I mean, you've kind of nailed it already, so I can just elaborate a little bit. But that is the basics of how they performed this cloning. For Dolly the sheep, it was even the same process. Those 20 years ago, they had an existing egg cell, and they got rid of the stuff inside it, and they put in a cell from Dolly's mother, technically, but the sheep that Dolly was cloned from.
Right.
So it was one of the progenitor sheep's cells, so it was identical to that original sheep. They put that DNA material into the kind of empty egg cell, stimulated it with chemicals and other secret sauces that the biochemists use, and were able to get it to grow and multiply and become a viable life, and it became Dolly the sheep, the cloned sheep. And so that was great. That was a big deal. It's important to be able to clone animals, not just to master the tools of genetics and engineering. That's important too. But having cloned animals also lets us do better, perform better experiments. And if you you know the basics about a scientific experiment, you want to have a control group that you don't do anything with, and then you have the experimental group that you actually change something with, you know, try to give them the drug or give them the treatment or whatever, and then you can see what happens all the better compared to the one that you didn't do anything toward. And if you have clones of animals, you have a perfect control group, because that way you know exactly anything that happens to it would have happened to the ones that you're working on as well. So it's really important for science to be able to get this stuff right. And as you said, for primates, monkeys and apes and you know, humans are in that group. We can talk about that in a minute. It had been very difficult to get primates to clone primates with this process or any process. But finally, last year, the news came out that Chinese scientists had succeeded in doing that. They cloned, like you said, two monkeys. We have some pictures of them. They're very cute in the magazine. And it was using a version of that same technique of kind of emptying out an egg cell and putting in the genetic material, but they had modified it to be able to work for primates. And without getting too much into the details, they had two main changes. The first was that instead of using just DNA from adult cells from the monkeys that they wanted to clone, they used fetal cells from monkeys, which react better to the treatments, the chemical stuff, and the secret sauce that they do. So they used fetal cells instead of adult cells, and they also had a better process for treating those, you know, that created cell and being able to make it more viable, reduce damage to it. So by improving that process, we were able, like we said, to actually create these two cloned primates for the first time in, you know, in the world. And so now this is great because we'll be able to better test drugs and understand how different mechanisms, how different biological processes work with a control group that is completely identical to the experimental group. And we are that much better equipped to kind of go in there and tinker with genes and genetics and understand that process that much better, too.
Bill, as we've spoken before, you and I are both space nuts ever since we were kids. And, you know, with Mercury and Gemini and Apollo and even the test flight program before that, it always sort of struck me that there was a seriousness in the way that people in space communicated with each other. That's where I first heard my first acronym, you know, an EVA, an extracurricular activity, you know, spacewalk. And they're all really serious, and everyone's really measured with their responses and stuff when you ask them questions. And then along comes Elon Musk. And the whole thing about putting a sports car in space with an astronaut, or the Flash Gordon landing of the two boosters simultaneously, and you have those pictures in your magazine. And those are iconic pictures that 100 years from now people will be talking about. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, Elon Musk is a great figure for us. I know personally at Discover, we always have at least one story about him in this the annual issue looking back at the year. So he delivered again this year. Like you said, it's super iconic. It does look kind of funny the first time you see it, this beautiful depiction of Earth in the background, the blue marble in space. And in the foreground, a red sports car with an astronaut driving it. And, of course, it's not actually an astronaut. Mm-hmm. It's a figure that nicknamed, Starman. Starman out there driving this Tesla out into the stars. Like, that's so poetic and elegant. And is it useful scientifically? Does it do anything? Well, you know, not really. It's kind of a publicity stunt. But in a way, that serves science, too, because it gets people excited about the possibilities. You see a photo like that, and you think, wow, we're there. We're at the point where we can drive Teslas in space. And even if we're not literally, we can't take a Tesla into space, we're close enough. That photo isn't manipulated. It's a real, you know, it's a real scientific achievement, as belied by the accompanying photo of the twin booster rockets landing almost exactly where they're supposed to, almost completely simultaneously, signaling that, you know, we really do have this capability. We really are getting much better at sending payloads into space. And so hopefully that will translate soon, in the coming years, into kind of a renewed interest in America's part on sending astronauts and other, you know, and payloads and other things into space. Currently, as a reminder to folks, currently we can't do that. There's no rocket ship that NASA has or anyone else has that in America that is sending astronauts into space. Anytime someone goes up, it's in a Russian rocket. And that's fine. Good for them, you know. But it would be also good for us to be able to do it. We were doing it for decades, and hopefully we'll be there again soon. So if it inspires just one kid to look at that Tesla and be impressed and that shiny red Corvette-looking car out in orbit, then it will have been worth it, I'm sure.
Absolutely. The Chinese also have been pursuing at least lunar landings recently. Wasn't it just last week? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Just last week to the far side of the moon, not the dark side. As a lot of people still like to say, there's no dark side. The sun shines equally on all sides of it. Pink Floyd said as much in the album, Dark Side of the Moon, one of the lyrics, there is no dark side.
That's right.
It was not a huge surprise. It was a planned mission, but it did land on the far side and is kind of set up residence there. And good for them. Hopefully it will inspire us to do something big and dramatic and impressive like that, too.
Great. So we're just about out of time, unbelievably, because we could just keep talking to you. But as you and JW stay in space, I stay on the ground. I am so interested in, you know, we talk now about health is so intrinsically tied to our gut. And bioengineering with biosensors, what an interesting story this is. So currently we have these little pills that have cameras in them, and we swallow them, and they take pictures of our gut to tell our doctors what's going on in the gut. But now there are going to be, or being developed, are these sensors that we will swallow, and they'll be able to tell us different things in real time on our smartphones about what's going in our gut, and eventually being able to make some corrections in our gut. So that one's really fascinating. Can you talk about that quickly?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the ultimate app. It can tell you what's going on inside you in real time. And the idea being is just a smart pill, basically, right? Like the Internet of Things will extend into our medicine cabinets. And you'll be able to take these, hopefully, small, normal pill-sized capsules, and they'll have bacteria in them that can interact with the gases in your guts, the microbiome that you have, the other, you know, bacteria living inside you, and be able to get more than just a snapshot, more than just a picture of your insides, but really a good analysis, a really good sense of what is happening, what processes are taking place. And it can broadcast the findings. It can send that data to your smartphone, to your doctor. Presumably there will be a Twitter app that will build off that. Everyone will know everyone else's intimate business. It's going to be amazing. And it won't be tomorrow that it comes out. The current version of some of these pills are still as long as AAA batteries, right, which is great for some animals, but humans, that would be literally a difficult pill to swallow. But they're working on that. Miniaturization is always a thing in technology. It's almost inevitable. It'll become smaller, easier to swallow, and then the next generation after that will be, as you said, not just getting the sense and reading the state of your insides, but being able to proactively treat what it finds there, releasing a medication or a beneficial bacteria that can combat whatever you've got going, being able to not just tell you what's going on, but actually do something about it. That's the future of smart pills.
Bill Andrews is the senior associate editor for Discover Magazine. And Bill, it wouldn't be early January without having you on to talk about this great issue. So thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Oh, well, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure.
And we're going to get you back on this spring because there's going to be something that we're going to need to talk about.
Sure. Yeah, I'm sure there's always, we could talk about all kinds of stuff. Even right now, I'm thinking, you know, that the Chinese lander, there's a lot going on there. Oh, Ultima Thule. Oh, yeah, that happened. This is almost old news, the genetic manipulation of the twins in China. Another Chinese researcher doing more genetic stuff. Like, there's always stuff happening.
And there's a piece on plastics in your article, and that has a shelf life of over 1,000 years. There are new plastics out there that decompose between 2 weeks and 7 years. So there's all sorts of bright things on the horizon for us. Thank you, Bill.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you so much.